And we are burning down the house here every Thursday at 8 on heritageradionetwork.com, a continuing conversation about the culture of architecture and design and everything related to the built environment, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment.
Hey, Curtis, this is Jack. We have a special announcement. Fairway is your sponsor this week.
Wow, how excellent.
Yeah.
Fairway Markets, Upper West Side, on Broadway in the 70s and also at 123rd Street.
And in Brooklyn.
And now in Brooklyn?
Red Hook, yes.
Thank you, Steve Jenkins. Thank you, Fairway.
That's fairwaymarket.com. You can shop online, too.
That's really cool. How do they deliver?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. And this evening in studio, our guest is Jake Allspector, one of my good friends from Cooper Union, the number one architecture school in North America, if we say so ourselves. And
still.
And still. This evening, we're going to talk about the profession at a crossroads, new masters of the profession, and how things must change, are changing, will change, so that we, as architects and designers, can rightfully reclaim the title of master builder, not merely building decorators. But first, breaking news. Friends of the show, listen to October 1st's broadcast when we had Henry Gifford, who is a tireless evangelizer and critic of the USGBC, the United States Green Building Council's lead certification process. Now, here you have it in Architectural Record, dated October 19th. In the newest version of the U.S. Green Building Council's Green Building Standards, there's an element that has never been before hinted at in the LEED guidelines. A green building can now have its LEED, leadership and energy, in energy and environmental design, certification revoked. Something that Henry spoke about right here in Studio A at Heritage Radio Network. And guess what? Suddenly, ha-ha, the new rules require building owners to submit performance data for 5 years after certification. And if they don't comply with providing the information, their LEED status can be rescinded. Now, it doesn't say that they're going to make any of this actually public, any of this information, but Henry loves to talk about how, just looking at the raw data, that LEED buildings do not necessarily use less energy than the average building based on the United States Department of Energy's own data. One for Gifford, zero for USGBC. Good work, Henry. You are indeed a hero in the ongoing struggle and war over facts, over feelings, which is a very important thing, especially for us in architecture. We need to deal more in facts and less in innuendo, less in just merely how things look, but how our built environment goes together. We must be masters of the entire process, and if we are not leaders, then we as architects will be sidelined, and other people who are willing to take responsibility will take our places. And that has happened over my entire career.
Yeah, it's been basically building for probably the entire 20th century, I would say.
Yes, I would say probably with the post-war period of a certain kind of designer who was more interested in aesthetic effect than being a master builder and taking responsibility. Let's talk about this interesting little essay by Nikolai Urasov, published in the New York Times August 23rd, 2009. As heroes disappear, the city needs more, blah, 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 blah. And he goes on talking about basically the five architects whom we know very well.
Too well.
We've spent hours and hours and hours with all of them, each of them, any of them. Heydick, Eisenman, Graves, Meyer, and Gwathmey. Now, Jake, you worked with Charlie Gwathmey for decades, I think.
2.5 decades,
yeah.
Yes.
And, we both knew John Heydick very well.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of training in architectural theory from Peter Eisenman.
Mm-hmm.
And we run into Meyer and Eisenman and sometimes Graves.
Mm-hmm.
Frequently. I don't think of them as heroes. I certainly don't subscribe to Urasov's elevating them to the status of heroes. Certainly as tastemakers, yes. But I really have to say the solution at hand is already happening. I really don't know why the New York Times architecture critic isn't aware. Perhaps we've been a little too modest in setting forth and promoting our attitudes, we, the new masters of architecture, about how it is that we undertake our profession. Are you hearing the screaming there in the engineering booth, guys?
It very well could be a reaction to the Yankees game. I'm just putting that out there.
Okay. It's again a game
go
two.
Go Yankees for the record from Heritage Radio Network.
I have to say I'm a National League guy, but that's only because I was born 3 blocks from Wrigley Field.
Oof.
Yeah, well.
As long as you're not one of the Mets fans that's betraying themselves by rooting for the Phillies. That's,
no,
you know,
never a Mets fan. Always a Cubs fan. Go Phillies.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up the New York Five in that context of master builders. I think Heydick and Gwathmey were both very into, especially Gwathmey, who basically half built his parents' house himself.
Yeah, but he didn't actually design his parents' house.
Well,
isn't that right?
A lot of people say.
Didn't Dick Henderson really design?
Well, he had a lot more to do with it than is commonly credited. And this comes from sources.
Richard Henderson. Sure.
Yeah.
And we both knew Richard at Cooper. And
yes,
he was the
New York Six.
Yeah, he was the unspoken Six. But then again, I think that happened because he was a very modest man.
He was modest.
Incredibly erudite.
Sophisticated. Very sensitive. And
did you go to see him?
I went to see him, and he had just been discharged the day before. He's been sick for everyone's benefit out there. And when I heard about that, I actually went to see him, and he had been discharged, and he's now somewhere in Pennsylvania with relatives and being cared for.
That is very cool. That reminds me of Bob Dylan going to see Woody Guthrie.
But he found him.
Yeah, well.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe we should go out to Erie, Pennsylvania, where I think he is.
Maybe we should and pay our respects.
Yeah.
Because he was a fabulous teacher.
But actually, that anecdote came from Gloria Heydick, who I called immediately after. This is John Haydock's widow, who I called immediately after hearing of Henderson's illness and knowing they were close and that.
Sure.
He was the associate dean for so many years at Cooper,
mm-hmm.
under John Heydick. And Gloria, who has told me the story before, relayed another story once again, the same story, that when they went out to see the Gwathmey House and Studio, which Charles and Richard Henderson had designed for Charles's parents, who were both artists, photographers.
Sure.
And
Robert
and Rosalie.
Rosalie.
And as an aside, Bob came up to them and said, you know, Richard Henderson had a lot to do with these projects.
Well, when you look at especially the studio buildings, they are so tight. and so perfect, and you look at the main house, which is an earlier version of the overblown kind of house that you worked on, I think, for Dumanil.
I did not.
Toad Hall.
I worked on only one house, which wasn't built.
Really? Oh, yeah, anyway.
No. Chen House in China.
That's very interesting to hear that that Charlie Gwathmey was really very interested in how things go together, because I look at some of the late work, mm-hmm. like the W Hotel at 123 mm-hmm. Washington Street, mm-hmm. Which I had been inspecting on behalf of the construction lenders every month. And I see windows without jam flashings. I see mm-hmm. windows without sill flashings. And I say to myself,
was that in the details or in the execution?
I don't think they were left out. I think they weren't there because they weren't there in the contract documents.
Really? That's surprising.
It was surprising to me.
Yeah.
And this is key.
Well, you know, what can I say? I'm no longer there.
Well, that's okay. I'm not mentioning this as any sort of indictment of your oversight, but merely to say that little details can make a big difference in the performance of a building over its 100 or 150 year life.
Absolutely. And flashing and things like that, which many design architects kind of, oh, what's flashing? We don't know, and blah, 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 are in the hands of some masters like Lu Kahn, actually expressed and celebrated.
Yes.
And the Gothic architecture celebrated as... And in all of the ancient architecture, the flashing was built into the stone and the way it was coursed and
that's right.
water tables
now,
and all
I would
of that
say
stuff.
Yeah. To that degree, then, that Lu Kahn is our prototype of a new master, because he was absolutely dedicated to taking responsibility for how everything went together. And it reminds me of that Bucky Fuller saying that... when I'm working on a project, if in the end it's not beautiful, then I know that I've made a mistake from the parts building up to the whole instead of from the whole
right.
coming down into,
a priori, right.
down into the parts, and then a sort of lotus eater sort of state of blissful forgetfulness overtaking the process and the building not being worked out except then during construction administration.
Right.
And that's where we take a drubbing, and that's yeah. where we lose our reputations
right.
for being morons when it right. comes to construction. And that's so wrong.
Yeah. It's interesting. You've reminded me that the Europeans have a very different system, and I think the rest of the world does, in which a lot of the detailing is actually worked out with the contractors and the tradespeople after the fact and done in the field. But that is the norm. That's the way that they manage that and call on the expertise of the trades, the way the ancient master builders, which is, you know, another term for architect, literally the master builder.
Absolutely.
Is the way they all operated. They were, in the Gothic, they were the chief stonemasons. They were the guys who were around the longest and had the experience and could, you know, kind of troubleshoot and tell everybody what to do and how to do it.
And they were masters of the entire process.
Mm-hmm. Of course, buildings were much simpler back then.
And no, they weren't.
Well,
no, they weren't.
The technology
really.
Of the late 18th and, you know, 1900s are, you know,
only,
did a big change.
Only to the extent that they did not have electricity, which drives artificial illumination.
That was one.
And our artificial ventilation.
That was one. How about the ventilation is the other.
Yeah.
Which,
so...
And the heating.
We find ourselves at a divide where many of the people in the building trades consider us to be, as architects, to be little more than decorators. We're mm-hmm. the big picture guys, and mm-hmm. when it comes down to how the building really goes together, so many of us either don't care or don't want to take responsibility. We've come to a crossroads. So let's have a little music. This is where we burn down the house. We're going to burn down the house of the fabled five. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Jake Allspector of Allspector Architecture. Jake knew Charlie Guathme very well. We're going to talk a little bit about this content in the Urasoff article. Jake, you were saying that you were preparing a lecture on Charlie.
Yes. After his death, someone had asked Bob Siegel to do a lecture on his partner and the work and all the legacy, and he couldn't do it and suggested me, who has not been with the firm for the last 7 years, after 25 years of golden handcuffs and lots of great projects and great collaborations. To get back to the point you were talking about master builders, it's interesting to use the five architects as a case study.
Yeah. Because they're so well known.
They're very well known. They had a lot of stylistic similarities, but you can actually divide. I mean, Hayduck didn't hardly built anything. He built Cooper Union in terms of renovation.
Right.
Did an excellent job. It's been very durable and all of that. And Gwathmey built a lot and was considered the sort of somewhat of a black sheep of the New York Five, being, you know, not really doing too many white buildings, but he used natural materials and let
them. Yes, he did.
And was very involved with the detailing. I remember, you know, the working drawings for all of the early houses being up in the hallways at Cooper as an exhibition. And I remember being really struck by the care and the, you know, rigor of the detailing and the construction sense and all of that.
Whereas I worked for Donald Butterfield. Did mm-hmm. you ever meet him?
Yeah, the name is familiar. I don't think I've met him.
D-O-N-A-L. Yeah. Donald loved paper, so he was an architect, an engineer, and a city planner.
Uh-huh.
And to hear Donald tell it, he was the one who worked out all those tidy-ass details for Richard Meier for the Smith House.
And oh,
for
I'm those have early, to find out about that.
For the, yeah, for those early yeah. white houses.
Which, by the way, I mean, I know there was another house on the island called the Hoffman House, which I know had been built the same way that Gwathmey did his houses, with basically tongue and groove cedar siding. However, the difference was they actually spackled all of the joints and painted all over.
So it would be
so that it would be absolutely smooth and abstract, which was also the technique that Peter Eisenman wanted to use for his houses. Mm-hmm. He didn't want any reference to anything
real or naturalistic.
Anyway, you know, just it had to be something, you know, avant-garde, radically new, totally platonic, you know, just no substance, no material.
A pristine pavilion that lives That's in right. a world without weather.
That's right. And needless to say, both the Meier and the Eisenman houses did not fare very well in terms of their
weathering.
The
Eisenman house in Vermont had to be restored.
Yes.
I mean, it's less than 40 years old. It had to be restored.
And not unusual condition, but it was particularly badly detailed because of the aesthetic goals totally outweighed the materiality and the constructability and the way everything was conceived.
Yeah. And that, I think, is, you know, in a nutshell, the difference between our immediate forebears and the more towards Luke Kahn's mm-hmm. Philosophy mm-hmm. that we are now attempting to carry forth, although there are plenty of people who would like to pretend that weather doesn't exist.
I think they still do. I mean,
oh yeah,
Frank Gehry got his start in Southern California, where it hardly rains, as the song goes, and certainly I remember the project at Loyola for the law school in L.A., which was all kinds of, you know, sheets of plywood and things, and going, wondering to myself, how did they keep the rain out of that? And
well,
I said,
they don't.
Oh, duh, there's
well,
no rain.
Yeah, they don't. And if it ever does rain, that's what God invented waste baskets for, I guess.
Yeah, buckets.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think there is a difference between the approach of some of the New York Five with some of the others. I would consider Gwathmey, you know, having been in that office, he very much loved the notion of constructability and all of that. He was grounded in that kind of pragmatics, which he didn't really sacrifice that much for the aesthetic, but he always searched for an appropriate material construction solution.
Well, always these conversations devolve into practice versus praxis, and praxis should be always with the pure artistic ideal, mm-hmm. whereas people who actually take responsibility or care about how it goes together are in some way hacks or mm-hmm. Or mere mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've talked about on this program before, this is not a new argument. The École des Beaux-Arts wanted to split the architectural studies, this is in the 1870s, into the purest, the aestheticians, and then everybody else. And Viollet-le-Duc said, absolutely not. We must keep it all together, because otherwise we are not masters of our art. Right. We are just drawing fancy things that someone else figures out how to build. And the mindset of caring about the materials, in his case, led to some really fabulous and wild expressions of cast iron structure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cast iron and stone.
Yes.
You know, the sort of tensile strength of steel versus the compressive strength of stone, which you can see in the Brooklyn Bridge.
It's absolutely.
Just a wonderful example.
But it gets us all the way back in a circle then to Lu Kan asking a brick, metaphorically, what it wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And it always said, I want to be an arch. And he'd say, but I don't want you to be an arch in this project. Or, no, I want to be an arch. But yes, brick wants to be in compression. And the only way for that to happen is in an arch, if you are spanning an opening.
That's right. That's right.
Now, of course, in New York, we have all sorts of ingenious flat, in the 19th century, flat arches where the bricks, in fact, are they're parallel pie beds. They're different shapes.
That's right.
And so that there's a keystone brick in the center of the flat arch, but that we have these slanted arch bricks.
Right.
And these buildings have stood the test of 150 or more years, filling in the bays between the rolled iron beams and girders. And they work very well.
They work wonderfully. I just renovated a space in the old Rambush building that had a flat terracotta arch with steel. And we didn't even know it was there. We assumed, because the rest of the building was wood joists and steel, that was the construction of the ground floor. But actually it was terracotta arch. And
wow.
It was very interesting to deal with
but
that.
But it was a flat arch.
It was a flat arch.
It wasn't
unlike
a Guastavino arch, for example.
Or unlike the sort of, like the B. Altman building is all shallow arches with I-beams, but they're terracotta, shallow arches with concrete dumped on top.
You know, just kind of, well, the Cooper Union Foundation building
that's the same thing.
Had originally
but brick.
That structure. Yes.
With brick.
Of course, that all went away in the Haydock reconstruction. It just gutted the building and put in steel and composite slabs.
That's right. Actually, for our listeners, there's a wonderful show at Cooper now in the Houghton Gallery in the Foundation Building on the history of architectural drawing and the history of the Foundation Building, which
that's right.
I recommend.
Yes, that's 7th Street at between 3rd Avenue and 4th Avenue.
Right.
And you go in and you tell the guard you go into the Houghton Gallery, and you'll walk up this semicircular stair promenade that circles around the round elevator shaft, which was the original elevator at the Cooper Union Foundation building. It was actually, they put in that round shaft before Otis had perfected the elevator.
That's right.
Thinking that, thinking pneumatically that it would be like a piston, which Peter Cooper knew very well from having
the Tom Thumb.
The Tom Thumb, the first practical demonstration that steam power could actually propel a train on the twisty tracks of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which then became a moneymaker because Peter Cooper's father-in-law had an iron mill.
Yeah. Do you remember the original elevator in that building?
I do.
and Cherry, the Cherry driver.
Yes. And she wouldn't take you to the third floor. You had to say red, orange, yellow.
That's right. You have to call the colors
of
the spectrum.
Yes, because there are seven floors and seven colors.
That's right.
What color are you going to? She wouldn't take you to the third floor.
That's right.
And she also wouldn't take you down in the elevator until 11 o'clock. If you wanted to go up and then come down, you had to walk down.
That's right.
And she wore white gloves.
Well, she was great.
And there was a graded hoistway entrance, I mean, totally against all fire codes.
That's right.
And she did that for 50 or 60 years.
A long time. But I loved that square elevator and the round shaft. I loved it sort of when I saw the Leonardo Universal Man, I always thought my gosh, that's the elevator, the square elevator in the round shaft. It's about the same proportion.
Must
too,
be smarter than I am. That never occurred to me. But the Leonardo man is a round man in a square frame. Okay, same difference. It's just in
it topologically. Was inverted. You're
topologically
right. It was
inverted. All right, that's fine. But that is the kind of thinking that we architects, you know, tend to have come to us.
That's right.
Sitting here in the garden of Roberta's restaurant, looking at the revelers in the garden with the fire pit blazing.
Those revelers are also, I think, testing out the motorcycle track. That explains the screaming.
The screaming and the low frequency vroom vroom thing there.
The rumble, yeah.
Yeah, they've restaurant has set up a temporary dirt track in the lot next door, where there will be having a party for low performance tiny little motorcycles over Halloween. This is the Halloween weekend coming up. We have not only Halloween but the World Series. So things are really hopping here in New York. And
what a great alignment of the stars.
I swear that Roberta's is on one of those ley lines, one of those geophysical magnetic meridians of power and energy, which if we wanted to get into talking about feng shui, we could talk about. But
no, you could actually, because what's really interesting is when I finally got a book on feng shui after working for a few years at Gwathmey Siegel and analyzed it. It was all the sort of syntactical rules that we had in the office for putting windows and doors and aligning things. Very, very similar.
Isn't that
cool? Very similar.
You know, after, 25 years of practicing and experimenting with color theory and just observing how light works with room coloration, I came to the same conclusions that later I found are absolutely feng shui principles, that the more light in a space, the lighter the color should be, and the less light, the darker the walls should be.
Oh, I didn't know that was part of feng shui. I have a very, very sort of sketchy book then. I'll have to get it detailed.
I learned that by being a beta tester for Kaplan's online continuing education program. And so I took the feng shui course, which was really good. Not that I'm giving Kaplan a free
Do they have testing thing? To be a certified feng shui master?
They do. To my knowledge, they do not.
Good.
But they do have a continuing education course on feng shui theory, and one of the aspects of that is color theory. And
I'll have to look it up.
For many years, I have used this rule that the more light, I mean by that natural light, the lighter the color should be. Because if you have a very bright natural illumination and you have dark colors, the color just dies. It you don't get the depth of color that you have when you have a dark room, and you have then a little bit of light, you can really almost step into the wall, like Alice with the looking glass. But if you have a very bright space, which is why, to the extent that those white buildings that the white architects did work, is because they're out in the landscape as a shining, clearly human intervention in the landscape. And the play between the real natural landscape and the house sets it off in a way that a dark stone building, for example, something that you might find in the Cotswolds, becomes part of the landscape instead of a contrast.
An object, right?
Yes. So, if we are to reclaim, rightfully so, and as an earned title, master builders, our younger listeners might say, well, how do I get that experience? Now, you got your experience working on many, many, many projects over the years in a highly successful gold medal winning firm. Not everyone is so lucky.
That's true.
Now, yeah.
But you know what? I think I think part of it comes from the education and the background of the person. I really do think that
And you're intellectually curious. I mean, I think almost all of us.
I think many, many people are. I think they also sometimes are either miseducated or kind of the education is very narrow and focused instead of broad and humanistic and expansive and encompassing of all of the things that, you know, not only architects but many professions should be aware of in order to really, you know, put themselves in the right place.
Well, what drew me to architecture, and I was mightily tempted by medicine.
I was just thinking about doctors.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand the sight of blood, so that was
blood doesn't bother me.
Out of the question.
No,
until my daughter was born, I cut the umbilical cord. That was fine, but before that, forget it. I could watch blood on TV and I'd faint.
No, blood has never bothered me. Somebody else's blood has never bothered me.
Ah, your own, huh?
Yeah, well, and when it's you, you can't fix yourself, but somebody
can
else.
Can we talk about vampires since it's Halloween?
Perhaps. Yeah. There may be vampires that we might think of in terms of certain clients that we've known, but we must not speak ill of our employers. That's right, because in the end, even though we're serving the public, in specific, we are serving our clients, the owners, the people who have the wherewithal and the desire to have buildings built. And we're happy to. But that what really grabbed me in terms of wanting to be an architect is because architecture is all-inclusive. Mm-hmm. Everything matters. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you embrace that, and want to learn about everything that goes into a building, the lighting, the heating, the acoustics, the color theory,
right?
The
materials,
the raw
physics,
materials, yes, the physics,
psychology,
of the chemistry of the interaction of different materials that as they weather out in nature.
That's right. Do you want to create a battery?
Yeah, well, that's why aluminum and steel should never be in contact, because then you've got a little battery going. And guess what? The aluminum's going to lose.
That's right.
Because it's higher on the electromotive series, which any architect who had to take high school chemistry should remember. But then we forget these things.
We forget, and do you know what? I mean, it's starting to be that some of these things are no longer required in school. I mean, I remember at City College, where I now am a professor, that calculus was eliminated from the curriculum requirement.
Well, you're not going to hear me moaning over the loss of... I got a D in calculus.
Well,
you know,
and... As I explained...
But I can do trigonometry quite well, thank you.
Well, okay. But as I explained, I think it was more not using the calculus, because we all use consultants and computers and all of that, but the idea behind the kind of creative problem-solving that calculus and certain higher mathematics sort of exposes you to, in terms of their different approaches to doing the same thing. And they're all legitimate.
I'll agree with you there, because you should at least understand that calculus takes aggregations of data and systematizes it so that you can come to, you know, a mean string of data that represent a kind of modeling that you could apply to the physical world.
But back to education, I mean, I think it's sort of that a technology, if you want to call calculus a technology, which I think it is, I guess it's almost 500 years old when Newton and Leibniz invented it. And all of us...
400 at least, sure.
Yeah, and it's deemed to be too difficult for people who are supposed to, as you say, be aware of everything.
It's not difficult if you have a good teacher.
That is absolutely the case.
And good teachers who can make extremely complicated situations clear
are the right
kind of people.
Right. And some of us have been fortunate to have those. And
now, to an extent, as architects, we are, for our clients, like trusted guides through the wilderness. And I think that the best of us can make very complicated technological situations that involve the buildings simple or attainable to be understood by our clients, then we've done a good job. And this is where I part ways with some of our colleagues who have had careers as academicians. There has been a trend towards what I see as a perversion of the English language that's been spun out through the theoretical writings of various people.
I think English majors would really be insulted by the fact that you call it the English language.
No. I'm not talking about English majors. I'm talking about the I see as part and parcel with the old masters, the theoretical musings of people like Colin Rowe. If you pick up the essay on the mathematics of the ideal villa, Colin Rowe and Bob Slutsky, mm-hmm. Okay? It is nearly incomprehensible unless you're...
Again, two of my teachers and probably yours too.
Sure. Unless you're in with the in crowd and they've explained it in simple English, you cannot read this essay and understand what the hell they're really talking about. Mm-hmm. And when I, from time to time, walk the halls of various architectural schools, and I hear one of the teachers or professors saying something like, "The student successfully attacked a robust program." I'm tempted to say in response, did they use grenades or bazookas? I don't like IEDs. I give no quarter to architect talk because it isolates us from the public. It certainly does not raise our level of mystique because there is nothing more magical than actually knowing everything about the building that's going up with your name on the drawings and mm-hmm. your seal mm-hmm. and your signature. Mm-hmm. Knowing everything about that building that is being constructed with you as the leader, the guide, the true master builder. There's nothing more magical than that, really. And
it's a trip.
It is a total trip to walk with your client and say, and over here is the auditorium, and they will say, well, what are these things hanging off the pipe? And you go, well, that's a pipe clamp, and the heating water is going to go through copper pipes that are being held up there. And then they'll come down over into this box, which churns around the water, and it blows hot or cool for
starting
you.
Starting to sound like a Monty Python routine.
But well, you know, there's...
rotating knives and...
I think
those guys were architectural students. Some of the writers.
Terry Gilliam was.
Oh, he was.
The guy who did the montages and, you know, things that ate each other.
Yes.
And I think it was his idea in Monty Python's Meaning of Life where, the corporate raiders were in a building that was sailing through the financial district, and they were firing file drawers out of the windows. You know, that was a total, architect's kind of fantasy about if corporate raiders were pirates of Wall Street, what would it look like, you know? And
great imagery.
Yeah, so let's skip the second break music and just have a little inspirational stuff from Queen, shall we? Mm-hmm. Can we do that?
I paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence, but can committed no crime, and bad mistakes I've made a few. And everything that goes with it, I thank you all. But it's been no bed of roses, no pleasure cruise. I consider it a challenge before the whole human race, and I ain't gonna lose. We are the champions.
Yes, it's true. It's true. Architects have an ego up there with jet pilots and surgeons. We are your champions of the built environment. And what else is there in the world? And that's what we talk about here every Thursday on Burning Down the House, sponsored by Fairway. Yes, you know, for 4 out of the 5 years in architecture college, at Cooper, I was a line cook, and I've kept cooking. And I have to say that I love, especially the Fairway at 125th Street. It's a gas. You walk into the meat department, you're in the meat locker. I mean, there's meat just out there because you're in a refrigerated walk-in case.
It's like Rocky, right?
Yeah. Well, except that no one's beating on the meat, but okay. And you know, the essence of the ingredients and the fabulous stuff that they have at Fairway, it for me, it's like going to a stone yard. Jake, have you ever gone to a quarry?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Somebody has to approve.
In Italy.
Yes, of course. They have to approve the slabs before they go to fabrication. It's like being a chef. I want this. I don't want that. Yes. Yes. No. Yes. This is one of the things that we get to do as architects.
It's a good analogy.
Like, I am the chef. I am putting together the materials. I am putting together the ingredients. I am going to spice it up with the lighting. I'm going to make sure that it's properly seasoned or ventilated. I want to make sure
it's all sustainable materials. Yeah.
That's right. Well,
sustainable organic.
That's right. So if we are going to be the new masters, and we are the new masters, you know, we're it, you know. Get used to it. here we come to the shameless hucksterism. If you as an architect think that perhaps you could use some help not being pounded during construction administration by endless RFIs, you should call me. My company is called CDA, Construction and Design Analytics. And if you look at the companion blog, you'll see a link to qualityfordesign.blogspot.com. And because this is what I do all the time, I am very efficient at it. Now, Jake, because He has a more developed master. He designs and he keeps these things in mind. And you can find Jake at allspectrearchitecture.com, right?
That's correct.
That's right. And we are two of the new masters, and there are other like-minded people around. And I invite them to contact me, magisterarch@gmail.com. Mm. Because, you know, we all need to know each other. Because we must take responsibility in reclaiming the title of master builder. No one's going to do it for us. The construction managers would just as likely be happy for us to take a 2% fee and let them take the rest of the fee for figuring out how
but
to build.
But they always need us because they can't read drawings, they can't conceptualize things, and
they don't have the training.
They don't have it. They don't have it, and they know it. But they've got a good marketing plan.
They've got a good marketing plan, and we have not been doing our job as architects, showing that we are masters of our craft.
I think part of it is also because we've relinquished some of these things because we think it's beneath us. But all of the great architects love to get their hands dirty. Everybody from Palladio, who was the son of a stonemason, who was a stonemason himself, you know, up to modern masters like
Lu Kang.
Yeah, Lu Kang, and that Japanese Coffin. Guy who was a stonemason too.
Kenzo Tange?
Yeah, one of those. I forget who it was.
Well, we'll have to do some research and get back to you all. Next week we can talk about that.
Too much good pizza and beer here.
Yeah, well, you know, as we know, the format, it's a conversation. This is not an interview show. This is not Charlie Rose. We don't lob up softball questions. We don't wear our intense suits and our ridiculous ties. We're people who are involved or interested in the built environment, having conversations about vital issues that raise the level of discourse about architecture, design, and the built environment. And those of you who are listening, let us know. Give us ideas about what you'd like to hear, because we're open. It's an open forum. You know, we do have a call-in line. Jack, what's the number?
Sorry, the call-in number is 718-497-2128. And if you ever have a question for any of our hosts, that's info@heritageradionetwork.com.
Very good. And because we're live streaming at 8 Eastern Time every Thursday, you can call in. You can participate. If you're an architect or a designer or just someone who's interested or curious, you can call in and we'll patch you in and we'll meld you into the studio environment here.
And if you can answer any of these crazy trivia questions you bring up from time to time, I'm sure Curtis will buy you a pizza.
Absolutely. And so we've about come to the end of our time. This has been Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Our guest has been Jake Allspector, master builder, a new master of architecture. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, and our wonderful sponsor has been the Fairway Markets. Thanks so much for listening. Jack, why don't you just let Keith Jarrett roll on all the way out? I love this music so.
That's good.
Thank you.